For tonight, I thought I'd kind of like to read some poems, some old poems and some new poems. That always seems safe. And the first day or so of interim, remember I mentioned that if you wanted to make some kind of mental notes and ask any questions about where some of them came from or why, feel free to do that either tonight or anytime while we're up here. Sometimes it's I think easy to talk about poems, about where they might have come from, and other times it's very difficult to talk about them, and I probably won't, but feel free to get the questions anyway if you have any. I'm going to start off with a trilogy of poems entitled The Auction Home and Death, and these are poems set in the Midwest, Nebraska, where I did graduate school, and maybe a composite of Nebraska and Illinois, where I grew up on a farm, Southern Illinois. And they came about in a kind of an interesting way. I had finished grad school in Nebraska and came back to a horrible house on a horrible street in a horrible town, right underneath the plane lanes and LAX. So every 60 seconds, a huge jet went over. And I had just come from a year of tremendous solitude and pastoral kinds of things, and to this kind of nerve-shattering noise and all that. And it was very difficult. My world had really sprung a leak. So trying to recapture, remember some of those kinds of events and images, that's where those poems came from. I remembered the one year that I just come from, in Nebraska, when I did allow myself some freedom from study. I usually went to an auction, either in town, down the street, out on the farm. And it was neat just to walk through these things and see all the stuff that the people had outside their house. A lot of you have been to auctions, so you know what that's like. For those of you who haven't, I might tell you, in the back of the house were tools, lawnmowers, and all kinds of stuff. On the side, usually crocks and glass kinds of things. In the front, sofas and highboys and chests, things like that. So it was kind of a picnic to be there, and kind of an interesting experience to walk around all that stuff.
Is it one person selling?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, you got the picture there? Yeah, that's exactly right. After a while, it got a little bit painful to go to those auctions because I was grabbing all this stuff and wanting to buy it and pick it up, and then you'd, out of the corner of your eye, you'd see the people on the porch whose house it was having to auction this stuff off but not really wanting to part with it. Nobody ever does. So I stopped going to auctions. Couldn't go anymore. But I went to enough that it was kind of burned on my mind. So then the second poem is called The Home, and that's picks up the story of what happens when the house is gone, their goods are gone, everything they've lived with for 57 years, and then they have to go somewhere, Sun City, California, or Miami Beach, or some silly place. And so the home is the place where the old woman in this story goes. And then the third poem is the death, and that's self-explanatory. So we'll start with the auction. He started at the rear of the house with the tools, while the ladies gathered near the front porch to sift through the personal things. All around the house, the furniture had been arranged, and after seeing the naked, shamed inside, which they had sat in for years, the older women found rockers in the front to sit in, and they rocked easily. The men showed up for the tools, standing close to the wooden benches and tables. They looked a convention of train men in their striped coveralls and train caps. Coveralls gaped at the side, showing blue denim shirts or long underwear, their burnt red faces screwed up into funny looks as the auctioneer approached. His one stump arm carried the black glove at a hammer angle. The men joked and looked away. They had already felt the length of the sledges or tested the bite and grip of saws and pliers, sideways glancing at him with nods, wanting the saw for two bits. Joking at the running words that spilled like an organized waterfall behind the frame house, the others waited with foot raised on bumpers of shining new pickups, watching but not bidding. They come at auctions. Who's moving? What's he selling? Why, that's all right, though I've got one already. As the seller of things moves around the house, the men trail off, pushing the mowers, hefting guiltily the long wrenches. Then the long line of canned goods and brown crocks, pickles watched by sharp-nosed women. And the late ones stand against the high boys stacked in front. The rocking women rock and don't complain if they can't see. The muscled man in front is buying glassware. He doesn't nod for it, but he buys the glass for his shop on the Milford Road. When the letters and scissors and beads and buttons are gone in the one box, and the round German pictures for frames, the rockers go. And the old women go home to bake and to wait. Then the small boys jump through the flower beds at tag, and the station wagon lumbers over the ditch with the bed spring sticking out, and the tally sheet is figured inside on a card table that didn't sell. So that's kind of the auction, you know, and then everything's gone. And then people go back to their houses, their homes, their lives, their dreams. And the old people go, and the second poem is the home. The hot morning sun sucked the shadow off the wide board porch where the old woman rocked. The bustle in the house was noisier than necessary, but she rocked the same for all of the talk that hung heavy on the August air. From her porch, she could see the ladies gather across the gravel street, their heads bonneted and bent in the trellis shade. Her long bony hands tightened on the smooth brown rocker arms. She shuffled her feet on the porch and lifted a yellowed handkerchief to her throat, then let it drop to her left. The sun spun in a mazy light, white motions in the beams that struck the hot roof of the pickup that bumped the ditch and rolled to a stop at the porch. The driver smiled a wide, clean smile and said, "Ma'am," as he leaped the steps and banged to the screen door. The old lady tried to say something as he jumped the steps, but he moved too fast in the sun, his face blurred in the web of years that held her in her chair. The ladies in the shade looked up as the family started out the door, formal, like an odd parade. They marked the ties, the old blue suit, the fans, the brooch, and how they passed the chair but turned in awkward angles to look before they got in cars. The old woman rocked and rubbed one hand upon the other, and felt she ought to tell them of her dresses that they folded in the truck. And the ladies on the swing cried, "Hush, and come out and see now," to others in the house across the street. The sun came up the steps, the chair rocked but slower, and turning once, she saw the neighbor's cat lying quiet in the gladiolas, watching the soft brown birds dancing in the bird bath. And she kept looking at the cat and the birds as she was lifted from the chair, her back held firm by long, strong arms, her head against his chest, the world moving around her as she watched. And all the world there was sat quiet across the street as the trellis vine stirred slightly in the darkness of the porch. The death. She tried. They had fixed her up a room like that she'd left. They gave her sun in the afternoons and allowed the fern bought by a cousin. The canary, a gift from her son, did not live long, but still she tried. The few pictures in her album were rounded at the edges from handling. She combed her long gray hair, brushed it, set the favorite comb, and went to bed. And the first long winter passed without a mark or sign to show she'd ever been anywhere but there. Then the spring and the hot summer. And when the trees turned yellow in the wood, she closed the door and sat on the creaking bed. She didn't cry or move at all, or ask for dinner when they came at 5, but only passed one hand across her hair to make it neat for anyone who came. No one did. An early snow covered nearly all the ground the day they buried her. The sun stood by as forms were offered, signed, witnessed. And then they started out and left the home she had never known. Past trees bare and white, past people moving slowly on the icy streets, and children's eyes looking up. Well, that's kind of a somber way to get into a poetry, I guess. Those are kind of heavy poems. But the images, we've been talking about images, and you people have been writing, and so you've written enough already, if you've never written before, to know, have some idea of how images are, and maybe how they get going. Sometimes they come out very quickly. Sometimes they take weeks and weeks. But the image has to be there. The image is the gift. It could be a person's face, it could be snow, it could be a rhyme, a sound, whatever. You have to have the gift, and then that is the given, and after that it's what, blood, sweat, and tears to try to get it in shape. If you have any questions, by the way, feel free. I hope you're relaxed. I'm getting more and more. And there's nothing sacred about a poetry reading. If you feel like clapping, clap. If you feel like asking a question, do that. Or just sitting in quiet, that's cool, okay? Are there any? You might be interested that I wrote the auction in the home came very quickly, and then the death came 10 years later. As if I hadn't ever lost track of the old lady, but hadn't really known what was going to happen. Usually the psyche takes care of those kinds of things. It knows what's, I think, good for you, and it'll bring up things. Sometimes it brings love when you least expect it and don't really want it. Sometimes it brings poems when you want them desperately, and sometimes it won't bring either. I guess that's the breaks.
Had you tried to write the death?
No. No, I thought the home was the last. That was it. Years and years after I went to grade school for 3 years at a Lutheran school, the rest of my education was all public school. But 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, I was in a little school, Good Shepherd Lutheran in Inglewood, California. And last year, 5 or 6 poems came about that, and I really hadn't thought of that would lead to anything in particular. It was just, you know, everybody goes 6th, 7th, 8th grade, and all of a sudden here's some poems. So I thought I'd share a couple of those with you. They're not heavy, they're on the light side, because one of the things that I did in grade school was kind of hold the record for being sent to the cloakroom, because I was always, Mr. Uffelman, my big teacher, was always leveling his malevolent finger at me and accusing me of something that I was totally innocent of, and say, go to the, it was always William Craig Miles who committed the sin.
Was that the same laugh that you talked about?
Yeah, I already mentioned that, some of that, didn't I? Yeah. So these poems came out, and a friend of mine, Roy Appleton, we were always getting in trouble together, so we were always, Mr. Uffelman's favorite form of punishment was sentences. He's, you know, 100 sentences and 200, 500, 1,000. I mean, just get monstrous numbers of sentences. So Roy Appleton and I sometimes it got so bad that we would actually miss a recess when it wasn't necessary, and we'd take 3 pencils together, and we'd write, I will not, and then kind of leave it blank, and then stuff those in our desk against the time when Mr. Offman would level that finger. And we could whip out our papers and just kind of fill in what it was we weren't supposed to do. Covet your neighbor's ox or whatever you weren't supposed to do. I once told Mr. Offman that none of my neighbors had an ox I could covet. And I was really kind of serious, but I got 500 sentences for that one, too. And to this day, I haven't really met an ox I could covet. There's something in those words somewhere, I think. Anyway, here's a short poem called The Sentence. I taped 3 pencils together so the sentences would go faster, because Mr. Uffelman said not to question the doctrine of predestination. And from my cell in the cloakroom, I heard the roll call of doctrines, and I waited for Laura Lee Appleton. Laura Lee Appleton was sat in the row next to me. She was Laura Lee Appleton. I'll read you a poem. This talks about Laura Lee a little bit. It's called After School. It's really very mild. After school, we always went to Roy Appleton's house, and he let us have hot toast and cold milk. And Laura Lee Appleton always changed her dress, which amazed us, watching her swish into her bedroom with us standing there looking at the closing door, and hearing her laugh as petticoats flew around the room in what must have been a delirious sight, and us munching our hot toast, and Roy Appleton laughing and barging right into her bedroom and her screaming and throwing something at him. And deep inside my body, I wondered about Laura Lee Appleton and those cascading petticoats and white shoes and anklets coming off, and my milk went down my dry throat cold and fast. Never saw her again. No. This is the poem called Fridays is Art that I mentioned. We were talking about art the other day.
Yeah.
How I always got F's on my art because I couldn't draw. 3 years of little red F's. For the people who weren't there at the discussion of the day, I'll just kind of back up just a touch. That obviously Mr. Offelman art was not his long suit, and he didn't care if it was ours either. So he always waited till 2:30 on a Friday to go to this big cupboard and take out big sheets of yellow paper, and kind of with a diffident attitude would go up and down the row and hand out the sheets of paper. And then he'd give us a compass and always got all kinds of apparatus which we never used. And 18-inch rulers and gum erasers and compasses and protractors. And the assignment was always the same, which I mentioned, you know, railroad tracks going out of town or a pussycat sitting on a fence. And I can never do either. I just never got it. Well, I'll just read you the poem, okay? It's called Fridays is Art. When the sun hit the top of the wire grating over the windows, which Mr. Offelman had installed to keep out kickballs, I knew it was 2:30. A magic time when the big cupboard would be opened and the large sheets of manila paper would come out, and protractors and crayons and rulers, and we would be expected, no, that's not right, required to draw railroad tracks going out of town. And mine always looked like a Christmas tree. And Mr. Offelman at 2:55 was already making his rounds, putting the neat little grade, always in red ink, on the upper right-hand corner of the large sheets of manila paper. And William Craig Miles, who always made good tracks, was already grinning at my Christmas tree and saying F with his mouth. William and I fought for 3 years on the playground and sometimes in the room. And he was my arch enemy, and finally we broke his arm. Fixed him. Except we were supposed to be doing sentences, and Roy Appler and I and somebody else just had it with William. And we tackled him, and we went cascading across Mr. Offelman's desk, knocking all his books off, and pounced on him. And just then, the door to the office opened, and I remember lifting up my head to see a huge black wingtip under my nose.
Uh-oh.
And I knew that didn't belong to William or myself. And there, 9 feet high, was Mr. Offelman. It was the beginning of the end. All right, this is the last one. This set's called Still Life. Laura Lee always wore those large skirts that at the time I assumed were worn by women since women began, which at 14 you naturally assume was all the women who ever lived. But Laura Lee was special because her eyes were always half open, and I couldn't tell if she was looking at me or at the ground. And I used to crane my neck and head downward to see into her face, which would blush red against those white cheeks, and her eyes would flutter open. And I never knew that Mr. Offelman was standing by my desk, those stalwart wingtips growing beneath my desk, William Craig Miles putting his hands into his mouth and rolling his eyes behind Mr. Offelman's back, and Laura Lee becoming a sunset, and me with my head down looking up into those blue, blue eyes and the class holding its breath. I think we are still there. No one has moved, and her eyes are opening now. So, anyway, those poems came years and years later. I had no idea that those were lurking somewhere. And there may be more. One of the things that I like to do back in Nebraska, there's not a whole lot to do in Nebraska, I found, except what you did yourself. And then after I learned that secret, I found there was more than I ever had anywhere else in Los Angeles or anywhere else. That's a hard lesson to learn, but once you learn it, then you never have to relearn it. And there's the confluence of Plum Creek and Little Blue River behind Concordia College where I taught. And I used to like to go down there and sit on this little bridge and dangle my feet in the water. It really wasn't a scenic creek at all. It was just kind of muddy and yucky. And in July and August, a lot of mosquitoes, and the water was muddy and sticks in it. So it wasn't pretty. But it was woods, and I was always kind of convinced that there was something going on in nature, something going on in woods that couldn't quite explain. Some sense of something, some force, call it God or whatever. But something there that, well, it's obvious. I don't need to go on with that. We're all here in the middle of it, and I know you feel it. So this is called The Woods. Those branches there, did they move? Stand close a while. Soon or late, it might be there again. I'll prove to you these woods can hear. Shh, wait. There, it made the noise. I heard it move, some subtle shift of shade beneath the branch. You say a bird, I say something else, some sound nature made for us just because she wanted to. You needn't look at me. If you want a name, bird will do. I know what I saw and see. Any questions? Comments? There's enough people from Minnesota around here to read this poem, I think. It's called Bright Spot Cafe. It's about cottage cheese, which is interesting enough when most people remember it, not Bright Spot Cafe at all. And I was supposed to be giving a reading at St. Olaf, and I got lost. And I had taken a car to drive down to a little town in northern Iowa, which I always forget the name of, a little bitty college in Forest City?
Waldorf.
Waldorf, yeah.
Where I was born.
Really? Yeah. Well, that's where I was headed. And I got there late, and they were at chapel, which, as I recall, down the street in the church. And so I sat around with my briefcase, and nobody seemed to know. They didn't want to poet anyway, so I kind of, they came out of church and they went back to their classroom and nobody still said hello, so I figured I'd better forget that one and go back up to St. Olaf because I was going to be late for that reading that night. So on the way, I was hungry and tired and I'd rented a car. And I was driving along, trying to find the road to Northfield, and suddenly I was reminded of being in the car when I was a kid. I was driving along, because we came from Southern Illinois, but every Christmas and summer was back to the farm in Southern Illinois. And just like clockwork, we'd get in our old Dodge, my dad and mother in the front, and I in the back with two or three dogs, always traveled with two or three dogs, huge dogs, I recall, took up the whole seat, and we would drive. And my dad had this interesting way of driving that when once he got over the wheel, his shoulders became concrete. And he never stopped. He just a massive down, he always said, gotta get down the line. That was always his favorite expression. And I would be sitting back there for the first 200 miles, bored out of my skull, but I didn't say dare say anything. Finally, I'd say, I've got to go to the bathroom. He'd say, can't stop, got to get down the line. I said, all right, let it go for a while. About 10 or 15 minutes, I said, Dad, I got to go to the bathroom. Let it go, I've got to get down the line. So finally, uremic poisoning was setting in, and I said, I've got to go to the bathroom. He says, shut up, we've got to get down the line. So I would kind of ease up over the seat to see this magic line that we had to get down. And I said, he says, well, I'll look for a bathroom. If you see a bathroom, I'll stop.
All right.
So I was looking for the bathroom out in New Mexico, right? I saw a bathroom. There's a gas station. He says, wrong side. Right. It had to be on the right side. And we pulled into some rock gravel with a big sign that said Jesus Saves on it and Zoo. And it wasn't anything. It was some whacked out coyote and a dead rattlesnake. And it said, last chance gas, right? Whiting's last chance gas. $1.05 a gallon. You'll never get any more to St. Louis. And just over the rise is Albuquerque. And then my dad's vision of driving, I guess, is a little strange. He would stop. I mean, stopping to eat was just unknown, you know, to my dad. He would stop reluctantly at a grocery store and said to my mother, whom he called woman. In fact, I was 9 or 10 before I ever realized she had a name. I said, woman, go get bread and bologna. So she would come back with this package of stuff and this bread, and he would gun her down the line again. And pretty soon he would put out this big flat ham of a hand and say, eat. It was like Tarzan language, you know. And my mother would take the bread, you know, like cereal, and then bologna, wham, and another piece of bread, and he would roll it up in the kind of a knotty, gummy thing, and boom, eat it. And he'd say, see what the kid'll have. I was the only one back there, you know. And I knew I had a name if my mother didn't. It was always the woman and the kid. So I hated bologna. I can't stand bologna to this day. So I wasn't thrilled about that sandwich coming over. And she would just kind of hand it over like that. And if I hesitated 1 second, one of the other dogs would... So I would go for hundreds of miles without going to the bathroom, without eating. So here I am, and stopping for motels. If my father stopped for a motel, which is highly unlikely, it had to be for under $5. Now, under $5 doesn't get you very much. And he never found anything. And that's why. But at the time, I didn't understand that was why. That was his price. So he would pull into a gas station about 10 or 11 at night, and he would get out, and I would get out, and my mother would put a little pillow or something under my head, and I would lie down on the asphalt. And that was sleep. And I would look up, and the stars wide awake, and my dad would be flaked out in the seat of the car. My mother sitting up, and that was... And then all of a sudden, at 3 o'clock, my dad was waking us again, got to get down the line. And I could hardly get up from the asphalt. And I said, why at 3 o'clock? He says, got to beat the sun, beat the heat. Well, we beat the heat, you know. I mean, 3 o'clock, you don't have to worry about the heat. But my dad wanted to get down that line. So we usually made it from Los Angeles to St. Louis in, I don't know, not very many, 36 hours. It was outside because we just drove all the time. So here I am going back trying to find Northfield. And I was tired, I was hungry, probably had to go to the bathroom, wanted a cup of coffee. And I saw a little cafe over here on the left, mind you, as I was going north. It said Bright Spot Cafe. So I kind of said half out loud, I said, Dad, I'm turning in. And I turned across the highway, and it was a great feeling of power to be able to do that, although a lot of guilt at the same time, knowing that he would have chastised me had he been there. So it eventually led to this poem called Bright Spot Cafe. The sign read, Eat. In a soft April rain, I pulled across the gravel white rock road. Use other door. And there wasn't but one door. While inside, the old timers laughed and pointed at my fumbling. Inside, to a quiet table, and the waitress. Bring me a cheeseburger and coffee. Want the cottage cheese? No, just cheeseburger and coffee. Don't you want the cottage cheese? No, just how about them French fries? She stood a while as I studied the tablecloth, then sidled over to the window and gave my order. And he don't want the cottage cheese. Such a hush then. The ramrod-backed farmers turned on their stools to gape my way. I flushed hot and studied the mysteries of my menu that showed the map of Iowa saying, you are here, Dubuque is. And finally, to look up at the eating faces all engrossed in their cottage cheese. The man across the aisle shoveling it in while his mother gave him what for with each mouthful. I say no mutton chops. Mustache okay, but them chops point your nose, Roger. And the words trailing off to a table next to mine. Dewey's is the best. There's a new man there who lays them out so natural you wouldn't believe it, and he's reasonable. $74, get your casket, wreath of forget-me-nots, and add the advocate. And that new man lays them out so natural. And finally, my cheeseburger. Small, rounded cheese, unmelted. I look in vain for onion, pickle, lettuce, and the hovering waitress noticing my hesitation. Now you want your cottage cheese? And silence again in the Bright Spot Cafe as chrome stools turn, farmers look, and conversations hang suspended in beatific silence. Yes, I say. And Iowa resumes its humanistic center of the universe as heresies and dreams alike are laid to rest, looking very natural. And I think part of that is not entirely, but part of that's due to the way I was raised on the farm, because my father, we lived on the farm, my grandma's farm, and my uncle, we all lived together in three houses, like a little compound on the farm. And they thought it great sport to scare the hell out of us all the time, my cousin and I. And they were forever scaring us. And they thought that was the best way to raise kids, is just keep them scared, and they'll do what they're supposed to do. And I thought every kid was raised that way, so, you know, psychology was a new thing for me to find out that children weren't always raised that way, but I was. And winter, Christmas, was the high point of this, for some reason. Maybe in late autumn, we'd be sitting out with my grandmother on a porch swing under the trees, and she'd be telling us ghost stories. And Bill and I, maybe it was August, because the fireflies were still out, and Bill would try to capture fireflies and stuff them up my nose and things like that. It was a great time. And my grandmother threatening to go in the house and leave us out there if we didn't behave, and so we'd say, yes, Granny, and we'd swing. And pretty soon, I looked over on the side, and it was a white figure in the bushes, and I just about wet my pants right there. And this white figure ran out of the bushes, grabbed my cousin, and started running down the road with him. And I just, oh, I said, Granny, Granny, a ghost got Bill, oh my God. And pretty soon this figure stopped, whipped off the sheet. There was my Uncle Bill, his father, saying, wasn't that fun, Billy? And put him down, and my dad and he ran off and said, well, we got him that time, George. And off. And I sat there in a puddle, and Bill was prostrate on the ground. And this is the way it went. You know, and in that night, we slept with my grandmother very often, Bill on one side, me on the other. And she said, if you kids are good, I'll tell you ghost stories. Well, we didn't need any more ghost stories. So we'd say, all right, Granny. We'd start getting ready for bed and pulling off my shirt. All of a sudden, I went right by the window and a face popped up. Right, right. Down I went again. And I raised myself, just peeked over, and there's my dad and my uncle running across. I said, we're done that time, George. So we got used to changing our clothes, putting on our pajamas flat on the floor. We weren't going to look at that window. There's probably going to be something at that window. And then Christmas, you know. We'd sit out there in this big kitchen and the pot-bellied stove like this, only, you know, stove. And all the men would tilt their chairs back like we're doing and put their feet on the stove. So Bill and I would tilt our chairs back and fall over and try again. Then the stove would get very, very hot, like a little nuclear reactor just pulsating. And all the people would start moving their chairs back a little bit, you know, like as a circle. The guy's still talking, spitting tobacco and chewing. And then pretty soon the fire would go out and the chairs would start coming in. So I spent at least 10 years just kind of playing around a fire like that. I thought everybody did that. And then I remember very distinctly about 3 days before Christmas, my Uncle Bill came up to me, and Bill and I, and he says, did you kids slop the hogs right? I said, of course we did, which we hadn't. We just opened the door and threw it out and let the hogs find it. But he said, put it in the trough. He says, well, he says, you better, because Claus is coming. I said, Claus is coming. And he says, Claus don't like kids who don't slop dogs. So for 2 days this went on, this constant threat. And I went, what the heck is Claus? So that Christmas Eve came, and my grandmother came in with this big set of keys, and she went to the big front room, which was never open unless Christmas or Easter or somebody died. We were never allowed in there. We lived in the kitchen. And she turned the key. I remember this porcelain, beautiful porcelain doorknob, which I always used to, when nobody was looking, I'd go lick it, because I was, my grandmother was strange. I finally got caught and was switched for that. So then Bill and I used to go out and play cows and lick the salt lick and get switched for that too. But anyway, she would turn this doorknob and in this huge room, about twice the size of this, with drop cloths and all the chairs and couches because nobody was ever in there. And they took all those things off and we were allowed to go in there, kind of a cold draft came whooshing through. So that night, Christmas Eve, my uncles and my dad and all relatives were playing cards and cheating and smoking cigars that they were not used to and getting sick. And pounding the table and accusing each other of cheating. And on this side, my aunts and girl cousins were playing some silly game where you stand by each other's chair and you wink and you got to change chairs and back. All this activity going on. And Bill and I are right kind of under the table next to my uncle, waiting for Claus. Nobody else seemed the least bit concerned. And all of a sudden, there's this kind of a jingle and a scraping against the house, and everybody stopped and looked at us. And we hadn't done anything. We're sitting there. And my dad put his cards down, and my Uncle Luke put out that cigar, and he says, I think that's Claus. And it was December 24th, and the wind was howling outside, blizzard. And he went to the door, and just then I heard this boom, 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 boom on the door. Oh, God, it's Claus. And my uncle went to the door, and he grabbed that porcelain knob. He turned around and gave us one more look. I don't know what for. And he opened the door, and in strode Santa Claus, this huge red suit, white beard flowing, and the snow coming in behind him. Beady red eyeballs. And in one hand, he had a corn knife, and the other hand, he had a big staff. And he came in, and he stomped the floor. And he looked right at us, and he says, where are the little bastards? Right. Everybody looked at us. You know, we were the only little bastards around. Old Claus came in, had this big sack of toys, and my uncle always helped him. He said, now, Santa, go easy on him. And, dude, you know, they've been good kids, and on, and Bill and I were just petrified. A corn knife. And he'd start giving presents away, and I was always amazed how he knew who had been. He'd make up some joke about my father. He says, Leslie, didn't I see you down at the corner drugstore with sister so-and-so on Saturday night? My dad would always sheepishly say yes, and everybody would roar and laughter, and I thought, oh, he knows everything. And on, and then he'd look at us and brandish that corn knife. So finally, all the toys were given out, and the gifts, and he finally got to us. And he looked down, we were, by this time, under the table where the cards had been playing, and he says, Billy, let better come out here. And Bill tried to push me out there. I said, you go ahead, Bill. So he'd go out there, and Santa Claus would embarrass him and kind of tower over him and make, you know, all kinds of bad things, and then give him something and cuff him and send him back. He said, Jackie, Ledbetter. And I had to go out. I thought I was going to wet my pants again and disgrace my father, who was sitting there with a cigar watching me. And I'd go up to Santa Claus, and he says, "Have you been good?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Can you sing a song?" I said, "No, Santa." He said, "Can you say a piece?" I said, "No." He said, "Can you do anything?" I said, "No." He said, "What good are you?" I said, "No good, no good." He said, "Well, take this anyway." He shoved something in my stomach and turned me around and kicked me right in the butt. And over I went, under the table, Bill and I clutching each other like that. Old Santa Claus grabbed this empty sack, strode to the door, grabbed that knob and turned around. He says, "Well, what a room of cutthroats this has been." He says, "I'll be back next year, maybe." And he looked right at us with that corn knife. He says, "You little bastards." And slammed the door and he was gone. Well, it wasn't for a long time that I realized that some little boys and girls grew up with singing hymns and songs of baby Jesus, and not everybody was scared to tell you.
Did your father and uncle set that up?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A couple of years later, we were playing in the part of the house we weren't supposed to be in, which was always the case. We were always doing something we weren't supposed to do. And my cousin Bill said, "Hey, come here, look." And I ran into my aunt's room, and there on the bed laid out was a red Santa Claus suit. And I knew, you know, oh, was I sad and mad. I've been had all these years. Well, anyway, it led to a poem, which I guess this was kind of a long prelude to the poem. It's called "Waiting for Christmas in Greenville, Illinois." They played the Victrola until dark and then carefully closed the great wooden lid and put away the thick, heavy records. Then the pot-bellied stove was lit, and Stokes, the hired man, sat in the corner chewing and spitting in the wood box in the same corner. Grandma would scold him and push his feet off the stove and tell him to go away. And while the laughter rose and fell like shadows, we listened for something outside the room, some sound of silence that we heard within the very walls themselves. And each night would find us sitting, talking, being the same people in the same corners, listening to the same magical sounds inside our hearts and within the walls to the cold wind blowing outside, to the meaningless scrabble of sounds on the walls of our brains. And each would be afraid to look in the other's eyes for fear it was real, alive, here, and waiting. And we waited for Christmas. Waited for that dreadful knock that meant the world had cracked, and we would be engulfed into the blackness surrounding the man who would stand in the doorway, a long white beard flowing about his shoulders, staff pounding the old floor, calling us by name. That was a heck of an experience. I just scared myself. For years afterward, I had nightmares. I would wake up in the middle of the night. Or I would not be able to wake up. I guess that was the worst part. And I would be out and opening some shed or barn in the barnyard. For some reason, the blackest night, and I would open this door, and there would stand Claus in this long red suit, and those beady eyes, and that corn knife. Heck of a thing. Here's a poem that is kind of a change of pace that I wrote after tour of Europe with Rich Kammerer and Omar and 37 other people last summer. Omar will remember this, and some of the rest of you may also, island of Santorini in Greece, where the only way, after you steam into the volcano, and the only way to get up to the top is by the donkeys. You remember that, Omar? You bet. And you don't want to do it because the poor donkeys are just emaciated beasts, and these runners drag them up and the tourists sit on them and they take your picture and sell the picture, and it's very kitschy. And yet if you want to get up there, you got to do it. Well, we went up that way, but we walked down about 500 steps that I had it with donkeys. It led to the poem called "The Donkeys of Santorini." Santorini is the name of the island, Saint Irene, Santorini. Santorini swims above the dark rock, rising out of the cool sea like snow, white as pain. And tinkling bells float on the water and rise like silver birds against the steep cliffs. They stand against the white walls, their necks stretched across necks of others. They will not lift their eyes. The drivers in blue shirts grunt and tug at the reins, the sun blasting the white roofs of the houses. The old women smile in shadow. As we wind among the narrow streets, our pockets bulging with sour dreams, our mouths bargaining for grace. And cactus catches at the lava walls, and the mountain shimmers in heat. Oh, my sister Saint Irene, in your cloistered walls in shadow, touch the poor donkeys, their sides sweating and heaving, lift their heads, their round soft eyes. Make me light across their backs, water on their heads, shadow for their eyes. Oh, my sister Saint Irene, the winding pebble steps ring with their hooves and sing sweeter than my tired prayers. Lift their heads, their round, soft eyes. Did you bring your slides with you this summer, winter?
I left them down in California. I had them up here last summer.
Omar and I have, without doubt, probably the collection, the worst collection of slides anybody ever did. Completely unorganized. Omar was my roommate for 6 weeks. And Scott Burrington, who was a lifestyler up here. Yeah? Okay. And three of us hit Paris like a whirlwind. We were going to tear it up. And the first night there, we ate at McDonald's. What a sad-looking trio, I'll tell you. I have another poem about that. Would you like to hear another one about that tour? It just occurred to me that you might. I didn't have it out to read, but if I can find it in a hurry. It's called Paris, Night Songs. One afternoon, we went to the Museum of Modern Art, a brand new one, which looks the ugliest thing I ever saw in my life on the outside, and probably the greatest collection of quote, modern art inside. And I was alone and wandering around and left and then wandered down to the Seine and just looked at old bookstalls and smoking French cigars and just one until I realized the sun was going down the Seine, and I didn't know where Samuel I was, and the rest of the people were back somewhere else. So I asked in the five or six words in French that I know how to get to my hotel, and it's called Night Songs. Down to the Seine, past decayed stalls with 1942 postcards and odd books. Night slides over the bridge, covering the water. The old songs will not do now. The old woman sings softly and waddles along the street, and people jostle her, curse her. She sings to herself softly. The air breathes in on itself. I inhale car fumes. Napoleon waits in absurd silence. We cross many streets, fighting battles we cannot touch. The old woman has stolen two pears. Her shopping bag swings into the Rue Saint-Denis. Bombs have fallen here, and Nebraska hisses in fields blown behind my eyes. The buildings crash inward, they are still falling. Yellow bricks cascade like woolly shrapnel, catch at my mind, stop at my eyes, scream along the winding streets like wind. The people hurry past, they do not look up. They do not hear the bombs or see the falling yellow bricks. They flow in ribboned waves, eddying in channels unspoken, no desire, no time to love or hate, intense without passion. Three bloody butchers stand in the street, their carcasses hang in heavy unison from iron hooks. The crowd eyes the hanging meat. One man steps around, though there's no need to be careful. Perhaps he is afraid. Perhaps he was afraid he will see them and dream of metaphors he has not used in a long time. Perhaps he already feels the hook in his side and bleeds from a torn gut, trailing a red line of shame down his leg. The crowd staring, sniffing, testing the unexpected guilt, smelling fear, suddenly aware of possibilities of death. They edge close, sensing his inability to ignore the red meat. The butchers stand, their aprons stained with running blood. They lean on each other and laugh, stare blankly at the crowd as they seethe around them like islands. They watch the man stop beside the curb, hesitate. He sees the crowd stop in place, their eyes red, their teeth protrude from long horse faces. Their breath covers him, and he will never forget. The geraniums are pale against the milky air. Her lips are bright. She sways against the doorway, not looking at me. Then she turns. Her eyes roll slightly. She is small, hidden in the early shadows along the alleyways. She has known I would come since she chose this spot across the street from the stairs where several women wait just inside the doorway. This is her post. She watches me closely. She clutches at me with words I do not understand. Two gendarmes watch from the car. One points to the woman across the street. They have stopped a fat man in a brown suit with a Milwaukee sticker on his shoulder bag, wingtip shoes. He stops and talks to the women, hefting his bag guiltily. The gendarmes watch him carefully. I look at the small girl, her face hidden in the shadow, her eyes dark and waiting. And we are held in still life, the women with their wingtip businessman, the gendarmes with clipped hair beneath bright caps, their eyes hard. And I edge away down narrow corridors to the Grand Hotel de la Havre, where stairs uncurl like some silent nautilus to lonely rooms above the noisy boulevards. I edge away from life to a silent but respectful death, proud of no moral resolution, aware of no ethical good, but shamefully conscious of pain and of a failure of life. Gordon, you're silent back there?
Yeah.
Well, speak up.
I don't have a question. Just say more about that.
Say more about that?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think I can. Really? I ask for a question, you ask it, and I don't answer. That's silly. Here's a love poem. It's titled Love Poem. This poem is for you, and I cannot say why. It is a poem I need to write for someone, and there does not appear to be any safe or true way to find her, so this poem is for you. And when you have read it and know it by heart, will you keep the words to yourself and not look up at me with the long lashes of you, nor smile the least bit, because I must acknowledge it, and so far I do not know how. The poem reads, this poem is for you and you alone. It is a love poem dedicated to the eyes of you that I cannot see, the arms of you that I cannot hold, the goodness of you that I would only spoil. This poem is not lovely in itself. It is not even pretty. It is not even true. Yet it is the only way I know. It is the only real way to say the words that will not come, that have probably died by now, that need rain. Talking about images when I started, and how you need an image. And I saw an image of the day. My leg still smarts from the tubing, the great record-breaking tubing. So I haven't tried it since. But I will, with my leg straight up and nobody on top this time. But I was walking down the road and some people were tubing and it was very misty. And someone had just come down the hill. And it was a magnificent sight. There was the image, and it led to a poem called Black Branch Against the White. You were lost in the mist that dropped into the trees on the hill that banked away, the terrible white drawing itself together. As you rode the banked ice and snow, a dark branch against the white, powder flying in your hair, eyes wide and laughing. And the mountains heaved themselves back down their glacier gullies, and the mist thickened, hiding voices on the hill. As you rested, half standing like a deer in snow, your breath small puffs of cloud. Well, any requests, if not questions?
I wonder why didn't you write a poem about trying on all those dresses and stuff in the shop?
I tried on dresses, Omar?
Well, no. When we were down there, the gal was trying on jacket when we were buying stuff to take home.
Yes, I was kidding. Yeah.
That was kind of a unique experience.
Yeah, it was.
People buying crosses. I could see a poem in it if I knew how to write one.
Yeah, well, you do.
We were buying the Jerusalem crosses to take home.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I had enough for everybody. I had to make my list shorter because they admired them.
And the most traumatized night of all was the last night was it Bielefeld, Germany? We had spent 2 days at Bethel with Pastor Funke at the Bethel Institute. And we had to make out our customs list, wondering how we could possibly get by with the tremendous amount of stuff that we had accumulated.
Jack, I have a request.
Okay.
That one right there, I think it's around the bench.
Yeah, sure. This is worn benches. Yeah. This is just a scene in Nebraska and Seward. You know, Seward is like so many small towns, just built around the square with the courthouse and all that, and the streets run off and then prairie, and then nothing but Lincoln or Omaha, 75 miles away. So I think that's the poem is self-explanatory. It's called Warm Benches. The old men at odds and at peace with the world stare the day down. The rusted hills falling asleep under the big hot sun ask nothing of these men. The crowd of puffer pigeons scratch beneath the green benches, hardly moving a wing in their rounds. There's no danger. Four sides, the squares, four sides. All the world is what they think of all day. The sides seem immense, the traffic abstract. The talking sidewalks lean in on them. The people threaten them with their walking, their breathing, their knowing and saying of things and their living. When the grain truck stops, they lean on their sticks and laugh, and later cry at the goodness of the driver, his stops, his cattle, his world. The park is small, the courthouse, hard gray stone in shade, and Brockoff's drugstore closes. The eyes see the sign turn in the window, see the bricks turn blue in the shade, and two pigeons light on the statue's rifle, scratching beneath their wings, the heads turning full round. The wind kicks the dust under the benches, the empty ones. The night calls them home for how-dos to the summer people, to Rolfsmeyer's for ice cream and the tilted rocker. Some sleep awakened by choking in the dreams and gripped comforts and quilts, and tomorrow, and the warm benches, and the benches. Anything else you'd like to read? Well, request time.
Did it come to your mind, remember the one I was talking about the other night, and I would have no idea what the name of it was, and I heard it like 4 years ago from you. Remember it? It was about, as far as I recall, something about an old lady. I think it...
Egg Lady of Plum Creek?
I'm not sure.
She drowned? No. Well, okay, I don't know if I can find it. I have a tremendous filing system here. Everything's numbered in the table of contents from one to something, except none of the poems are numbered, so it doesn't help with what I'm doing. I knew I was leaving out something like this. Well, I'm halfway there. What the heck? Okay, this is the Egg Lady of Plum Creek. When I lived, one of the years in Seward, lived on 5th Street, a little slanting hill that ran down to the creek, and I'd be upstairs typing away, working, and every Wednesday or Tuesday, I guess it was, or Wednesday, here I look out the window, this little old lady would come kind of gliding down the sidewalk, and she had great large skirts on, and I never saw her face because she was always wrapped up in a shawl and these big skirts. And I never saw her feet. She just kind of came down to our driveway and then came in, and she'd glide out and go down the next one. She's like a little on rollers. I never saw any part of her except this little body moving around. She's selling eggs. She had a little egg farm down by the river.
Yes, this is it.
That's it? Well, this is for you. The Egg Lady of Plum Creek, Seward, Nebraska. She died the day the crick got out, or rather because the crick got out. The account's buried. Ted, the produce man, said, it was because she saw all them pullets and white leghorns and Rhode Island Reds floating right off their nests right into the creek. Two boys on bicycles said, we hit under a big elm and saw her come running down the slope grabbing chickens and screaming for help. The Seward advocate said, Mrs. Hetty Tischhauser of this city drowned Tuesday afternoon in Plum Creek despite rescue efforts by the Childress brothers of nearby Wahoo. Arrangements are being handled by Dewey and Sons. Disposition of her lands at public auction. As soon as the creek goes down, there will be no egg delivery Wednesday. How about a poem based on a chapel talk I gave at Seward one year? Okay? Are you with me? Still? Don't want to talk you to death. Mark Twain says that's a horrible way to go. And I've been there, and I don't do it to you. Everybody that taught there had to do a chapel, all right? So my turn came, and I thought it would really be artsy-craftsy if George, my office mate, I said, George, you dress up as Jesus. He already looked like Jesus, anyway, he had a beard. And this was November, and I said, put on a brown robe, put on your sandals, and I'll grab a camera, and we'll go down to Plum Creek Woods, and you jump around and do things, and I'll take pictures. George said, far back, we'll do it, and we did it. And we took all kinds of pictures, and when I got back, I checked out the mold out of the music library and put that on tape, and I wrote a little thing to go with it. And for the assembled multitudes, I did my chapel. And about 2 days later, I got a note in my mailbox from the dean of the chapel saying, I'd like to see you. I thought, hot dog, at last the recognition I so richly deserved. And I walked in proud as punch. And this guy, I can still see him, had forgotten his name. No, I haven't, but I better forget it. He had a frozen smile. He used to kick kids out of college with a smile. You're out, go home, you know, smiling. God love you, out. So I walked in, and he had this smile. I thought, whoa. He said, about your chapel. And I said, yes, Dean. He said, the secretaries didn't understand it. I said, well, I'm sorry about that. He says, and besides, it was pantheistic. Then the smile left. And then he said, and where was the gospel message? That's when the Irish hit the fan.
All right.
I said, I had 36 slides of Jesus Christ. I had to hold up a sign that says, gospel. And then the smile came back. He said, if you'd like to redo it, and work on it again, we'll show it again. I said, thank you. And that was the last chapel I gave at Seward. And anyway, it led to the poem, which you make a long story short. And the poem is called Reflections on a Seward Chapel Tub. George had dressed as Jesus. I had my camera, and we went to Plum Creek Woods. George, or rather Jesus, jumped over logs, ran through thickets, beard flying, and rested on the ground exhausted. Jesus danced on the new ice on Plum Creek, slid about and waved his arms. I laughed and tried to catch it all, snapping pictures until the farmer's dog came up sniffing Jesus' robe. I snapped that too. Jesus pounding the big dog's chest and them running together down the hill with the late November sun catching at them flashing through the barren trees and softly falling down the hillsides. The purple Nebraska sky eddied among the logs, trees, and I showed my chapel slides, was told the secretaries didn't understand it, and further said the dean of chapel, it's slightly pantheistic. All the slides are in a box somewhere beneath bathroom towels, I think. George left for the University of Florida, and I reflect now and again when I see the sky cover over and smell spice in the crisping air. I recall a young man pounding the ground with his strong legs, and I still see him breaking the ice and scooping the cold, clean water to drink, his eyes laughing, his teeth white. And I wink in my sleep at Jesus and see him in my mind's eye on Plum Creek, the wind blowing brown branches, and I hear the leaves dry rattle on the hill. And Jesus, his face hidden in the folds of his cloak, becomes a cave and merges with the purple sky until he's lost in the night. And he sends me sleep. Purple, sliding down the hill, turning the ice blue.
Why did he think it was pantheistic?
Treason.
Yeah, well, yeah. He went into a long harangue about it that at a later time. I guess he figured his first talk didn't take, so we had at it again once. And he set me right on pantheism and the evils of reading Wordsworth. I never forgot Wordsworth after that. I loved him all the more.
Jack?
Yes?
Uncle Drunkard. I can never pronounce that title.
Bocce Piok?
Yeah.
I'll do it for you, Gord. Let me read this one poem.
All right.
I just turned to it. It's called Better Than Gospel, but I just happened to turn to it. We live in Seward, I was teaching there, and St. John's Seward is a horrible-looking brand. Well, anybody from St. John's Seward, you might be offended at that. But it looks like Howard Johnson's. It's just terrible. Inside is beautiful. The baptismal font, the altar. It's all white concrete with mosaic around it. It's just beautiful, but the outside is terrible. And the stained glass, they have little bits of chips of glass, and really neat. And the preacher was about 500 pounds, looked like a big bull moose. And he would start at the back and come running up the aisle and just scattering children and old ladies as he went to the public. And it was just horrible sermons. It just awful. But I would try to sit over on the one side where I knew the sun was going to be coming through those glass. And I would kind of sit and watch the way the glass lit up. And it was really nice. So it led to a poem called Better Than Gospel. The pale sun filtered through the oddly shaped pieces of colored glass and striped the pew in front of me. I was glad for the diversion, as the gospel was yet a long way off, and the epistle was being sung by the choir, who had been coached by Mrs. Kleist in the proper way of choiring epistles. The minister looked dubious and belched into his hymn book. The acolyte stood when he should have sat, and the congregation, ever on the alert for new dimensions in worship, rose. Then the minister had to rise. And the choir director, thinking that some kind of heavenly cue, cut the choir off short. And I, after all, had my spectral sunbeam oozing its way across the lovely pleats of the girl in front, in a perfect hush, with everybody standing and waiting for the choir, or the minister, or the acolyte. And I smile at that, thinking it better than gospel. Thank you. Very kind. What do you want, Gordon?
Bachi
Piak. Bachi Piak. Okay.
And a story.
Yeah, here is. Bachi Piak is Bohemian. It means uncle drunkard. And the southeastern Nebraska, as some of you know, is full of Bohemian people. And they're very proud of that heritage. In fact, towns like Wilbur, for example, right on the highway, it says, Wilbur, Nebraska, 100% Czech. And they have big Czech festivals, and the women wear really gaily colored dresses. Beautiful. And so one time, Bill Wolfram, an artist friend of mine, a collagist from Seward, and I were going to find... looking for a town called Dwight, actually. We never did find it. We didn't get there because the bridge was underwater, and there's all kinds of... That's another story which is not germane to this, which is an interesting story nonetheless. So instead, we went to this little beer place, little tavern out in the woods, and Eleanor and Murph's place. And I have a poem called Eleanor and Murph's Place, too. And it was a Polish wedding. Well, actually, that's really the poem is the story. So, because if I start telling that story, I'm liable to get lost and forget, and I'll be off glazed over somewhere, off to Des Moines. All right, it's called Bachi Piak, Uncle Drunkard. Just imagine this wedding. The slicked aisle narrowed with the pounding of the dance. The troop banged through the screen door and hit the bar with flat red palms. Uncles, friends, some criers, some laughing slappers boomed down the dancing aisle floor like a tide. The couple watched in wonder, then smiled as the bride appeared in the doorway. An accordion punched out some chords, then squeaked through a hot Polish dance. Mr. and Mrs. behind the bar grinned in mute appreciation and sent foaming glasses spinning and swirling, twirling down the polished bar. Like a great shy queen, the bride against the corner of the room clapped and smiled at the swaying and stomping, then grimaced as a slight blonde girl screamed and threw her arms tightly around the groom, who swung her in a wide arc off the ground and half dragged her down the thin corridor of dusty tavern floor to the arched hands that clapped them through the sweating tunnel. And springing outward from the dark, the uncle landed, knees bent, arms akimbo, silence in the room. Then slowly from the corner comes the accordion punching minor chords in a heartbeat cry that dancers, drinkers took up with hard hands as uncle straightened, grinning. Right foot, left foot comes the stamp of his feet while keeping his legs very straight and close together. The quiet couple sit with gripped hands on the tabletop, holding breaths. Sudden in the dance, uncle spins and flails his arms, his striped double-breasted suit flaring from his thin sides, fanning the dust from his stamping scuffed shoes that kick upwards, front and backwards, whirling faster, stomping harder. Uncle cries through clenched teeth a terrible whine that sets the watchers whirring, moving to and fro with a steady rhythm from the accordion. Dark lines with sweat stand out on Uncle's head. Eyes tired and red are closed in some great oblation to the spirit of the dance that robs the wedding feast of its frolic. The bridegroom moves from the thin blonde and watches his bride sway against the wall. Uncle bends deeply, bending his knees with hands on hips, swaying straight again, his feet banging the floor in golden motts of tangled fire, and down the expectant night crashed the thunder. Then the uncle stops in step, eyes open wide, red faces stare from seething coasts and black collieries of memory. tea's all gone. When I taught high school years ago in Los Angeles, this just popped in my mind. There were a couple of girls that were just really, really beautiful girls. And I was really fond of them. And one day they came to me and said, "Guess what?" I said, "What?" They said, "We met Brother Ross." I hated him immediately, you know. I don't care about Brother Ross. I'm talking about Brother Ross. And Brother Ross led prayer meetings at some house up on a hill in the Hollywood Hills on Wednesday nights. And these beautiful young things had indeed gone to Brother Ross and had seen all kinds of wonderful things and came back and were telling me about it. And if I can find the poem, which I probably shouldn't have started talking about until I had in my myths, I'll read you the poem about Brother Ross.
Did you go to school?
Yeah. And they really thought Brother Ross was excellent. It's got to be here. How about a poem called Spaces? I can't find Brother Ross. I'll find it.
Sounds good.
All right, Spaces. This was written when I was thinking about spaces between people, the attitudes between each other that we... I once, when I was studying French for my exam, I read a little book, a play, and I'd forgotten the name of it, and I'd forgotten the author, but it was very sad because these two lovers in Paris were killed in a riot or part of the resistance or something, I've forgotten what. But then they came back as spirits, and they met in this beautiful Parisian park at the bandstand, and the band was playing, and it was May, and the blossoms were beautiful, and they walked up and met each other and danced the way they did when they were alive, except they couldn't touch each other. It was the saddest thing I ever read in my life, embracing and yet not touching. So I wrote this poem, it's called Spaces. It hopefully addresses that issue of people who, for any number of and a variety of reasons, would love to touch and either cannot or must not. Spaces flow into quiet, protected corners of bodies. Spaces breathe in and out, sliding along your warm throat and at the back of your neck. Spaces find caves of night where flowers bend on hills dark against the night sky, the air floating into petals and lifting leaves with floating fingers of air in perfect silence. Spaces as water on smooth stones, between water and stones, moss overhanging, touching tendrils to the water. Spaces created from nothingness, created from distance, becoming touch and space at once, moving toward you, your eyes open, touching. The flower blooms quietly before the darkness of the cave. Our bodies slide in water, between water and stone, between water and water. This sense of space quickens atoms of touch, flower and water, and the spaces vanish. Now, see if we can find Brother Ross.
When you read poems at universities and stuff, do you give explanations like giving us?
Not as many. If a poem calls for it, then I will, but not like this. This is an unusual kind of a reading. Usually you're on a stage or something with a microphone, and yeah, it's kind of formal, or fairly formal. But this is so neat that it's just kind of, it's easy to talk about the poems. It's not always easy to talk about them. Some poems you don't talk about at all. They're extremely private and very personal. And you just don't do it. I still can't find Brother Ross, but I just came across a poem called Kowloon Suicide, which I thought might be a thing. I was reading poems in Hong Kong 2 or 3 years ago, and I was lost and alone and walking down the street, and a woman committed suicide by jumping out of a window and landed about 10 feet from me. And I was, you know, as anybody would be, that was it. I wiped out. I couldn't cross the street for 20 minutes. I finally did cross the street and found my way back to the... I was meeting an editor of a magazine who was my host in Hong Kong, and who had flown me over there for that purpose. And then I was to record some poems on Hong Kong radio. So, still in a stunned state, I wrote the poem in the taxi as we drove over to the radio station. It's called Hong Kong, Kowloon Suicide, 1976. There are many ways to be alone, feeling the monsoon wind over Victoria Harbor, the street teeming with people blown like bits of paper against the coming dusk. A woman bit her hand and looked away, another cried, but the black-clad figure in the street stifled any scream. There was no room for sound anymore. She lay face down in blood, her left arm outstretched in soundless wave. People pointed up to windows, glazed and noisy. I stopped. Traffic moved in the streets. Behind me, girls in white uniforms came arm in arm and laughing. Cars battled for left turns, their horns crying, danger, danger. And still I could not move beyond her. Her matted hair drying in the wind, she was a black streamer on the street. A sign, a presence I still feel, still see mirrored in the faces of the crowd that pushed to see. Laughing faces contorting into pain, disbelief at this black figure pointing at nothing ever again. Finally, I crossed the street, fence, fist clenched, my stomach sick with fear. At my lack of knowledge, my lack of something, something was missing. This crossing of the street, marked by black and blood, this street of faces, staring at wires above, two policemen running the crowd from up the street, beginning to see. I reached the curb and watched the coming faces for signs of recognition, for some sign that they shared my feeling of loss or weakness or horror at keeping my way beyond her, of not looking or not stopping. I wanted to scream, I care. But faces kept coming, coming, unseeing, unknowing, blown along by the monsoon wind up from Victoria Harbor. Well, I think it's time to, I'm not going to close on that note. I'm going to find something a little lighter.
Brother Ron.
I can't find Brother Ross. I'm going to, how about Waiting for the Fourth? You ever have a time in your hometown where you got together in Christmas and 4th of July and all that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. You know, okay. This is Waiting for the Fourth. Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. Hot damn. Mm-hmm. It's good. Okay. Waiting for the Fourth. When it was dark enough, we got out the sparklers and lit them and did cartwheels in the air. Uncle Frank lit his pipe and we all wanted to have a puff of it. Aunt Letha told us to get down off of him and act right or the sparklers would be over. Bill cussed and his mother said not to. I tried it and no one heard me. So we threw the sparklers in the air. One landed on the roof of the chicken house. My dad ran to the well for water. Aunt Letha came after us. Frank put out his pipe and it was over again. You like truck stops?
Yeah.
Cairo, Illinois. Anybody know where that is?
Yeah.
Used to call it Cairo, Little Egypt.
Cairo, yeah.
Far out little town. Cairo, Illinois truck stop. You said the milk duds were soft, and a fly skipped in a milk ring on our tabletop. The wide-bladed fan hummed sadly overhead, flicking black-white shadows over the peeled linoleum floor. The beefy policeman toyed with his coffee, watching the waitress fill the ketchup bottles. The screen door banged open and two rednecks wearing Funk's hybrid t-shirts and baseball caps wrestled each other to the counter. The trucker spat on the floor and slapped a dime down, while the man handing out Gideon Bible smiled at the waitress and said, "Jesus saves." She blinked at him through straggled blonde hair and held the half-filled ketchup bottle like a torch. The hamburger came burned with no cheese, no lettuce, no pickle. And from the jukebox, Furlan Husky moaned, "I'd walk a mile." And from the corner TV glowed warmly and Walter Cronkite beamed beatifically and pronounced the world good. Okay, I think one more and that'll be it. Unless somebody has something you want me to read, or a question, or a comment. about any of the poems or anything?
Do you write for members of your family?
Not very often. Rarely, as a matter of fact.
Is it more difficult to do that?
Yes. Very difficult.
Jack, you find yourself writing after the fact or during the fact? I mean, you know, like July the 4th things and Cairo truck stops, are they written in the truck stop? Are they written 3 weeks later, 3 years later, 10 years later?
Hardly any are ever, found Brother Ross, okay? Hardly any are ever written on the spot. The first time I ever taught creative writing, I was really full of artsy, craftsy ideas, and I took my class and I said, bring clipboards. This is back in Nebraska. I said, we're going to go and we're going to write poems. So we went down to Plum Creek Woods, and I said, I want you to really get into nature, you know, we're going to write. So one kid climbed up a tree and sat, and somebody else crawled under a bush. One guy went down by the bridge and dangled his feet in the water, and I was very pleased with all that. I knew they were really going to groove on this. And I kind of wandered around, I came back in an hour to see how they're doing. The kid up in the tree was just kind of gazing off, you know. Guy, I looked under the bush and sound asleep. The girl on the bridge was still flopping her feet in the water and talking to some guy with his feet in the water. I learned one lesson. You don't go out after poems with a net, you know, to bring them back. I think, well, some people do. I mean, I don't keep a journal. I always wish I had and drop down things. I think what you have to do is live your life. And as Gerard Manley Hopkins said, the sweet, sour, dazzle, dim, the good and the bad, the sweet and the sour, and you take what comes. And then hopefully, if you're lucky, later, as Wordsworth said, and what did Wordsworth say, Gord? I always foul up the quote. Emotion recollected in tranquility. But once in a while, Jim, something will happen that startles your senses so dramatically that you've got to write the poem or bust.
That's and like then that Cologne one, didn't you?
That
you
came.
Wrote it right.
Yeah.
In the taxi, in the way.
And the black branch against the white came just like that. The juices start stirring in the guts at those times, and you know there's not any force on earth that could keep that poem from coming. Mm. But that's rare. Brother Ross. The stairway curved around the core of the old home set high in the expensive hills. Gospel music played from a Wurlitzer in the corner. Brother Ross sat apart, hands clasped in front of his face, index fingers pointed up. His face, caught in the fire reflected glow, increased the dark crevices and wrinkles on his face. Presently the people grew hushed, expectant, and the organ swelled with a hymn. They sang, and Brother Ross rose and took the hand of the new one there. She had come to see, to hear, and to believe. Her eyes grew large. She glanced around at the others who swayed to the hymn, reflected shadows of sounds, low and intense. And Brother Ross prayed. He prayed with her hands in his. His watery blue eyes flicked into hers like thumbtacks. Held her as the sounds billowed all around, and from far away she heard the sounds of lake water pounding the rocks on Gennesaret, and the gray water stand still, smelled the fresh bread and tang of sharp wine with muffled sliding of sandals and the burnished copper plates of elders and priests. Hallelujah, cried Brother Ross, she's going under. Somebody opened the book. And the new one moaned and moved gently to and fro by the unseen hand stretching across the dark room. Brother Ross guided her past the intoning multitudes. He raised his right hand and they parted to the rejoicing of the fellow sufferers. The woman with the large wart rejoiced. The old man on the chintz couch rejoiced and played with his zipper. The organist rejoiced behind the Wurlitzer, his red tie bobbing up and down with the chords. And Brother Ross led her through them, beyond her own imagination, and she cried softly for so much happiness, and flinging wide her arms cried, Praise God! And Brother Ross buried his head against her breast and sighed, Amen.